Tonight we'll first hear a lecture from Risto Marjomaa, where he looks into the state of the world now at the end of the year 2024. And the lecture will then be followed up by a panel discussion with experts from the University of Helsinki, in which we will further investigate the current problems, solutions and possibilities of our time. And the event will also be recorded and published on our website and YouTube channel. My name is Max Talberg. I'm the founder and chairperson of the Global Visions Association. We act as a platform for the discussion on how the state of the world can be improved, especially from the point of view of global justice and equality. And we also highlight different societal visions regarding all of this. But now, over to you, Risto, please. The stage is yours.
Thank you. Okay. With my students in the university, I usually start with maps. Maps are very good in pointing out what maps do not tell. Maps always lie. Maps are always incorrect. But they are a good starting point for a discussion. Today, our starting map is a map which is kind of an image of our new world as a new Cold War. That was what interested me in this map. It puts against each other the Northern Atlantic Treaty Organization, the NATO, with its blue representation, and also countries allied to it, like Australia, Japan, and so forth. And on the other hand, the BRICS countries, the countries that have been collected roughly around Russia, India, and China, with other more minor partners included. And if you would use this card as a starting point of our modern world, it will seem that we are indeed divided into two blocks, and that even the red block, the BRICS countries, are now the larger one. In a way, yes, this is true, but on the other hand, whereas the NATO is a very strictly organized political system, the BRICS countries are not. And thus, this map mainly manages to cause dread or confusion, depends on where you look at it. The two pictures on the last slide, there is Israeli defense missiles trying to shot down Irani missiles a few months ago. And on the other hand, we have flood in Bahrain, in the Arabian Peninsula, a few weeks ago. Bahrain is not the country where you expect to have floods, being a desert country. And this is to show you how worldwide, how global our environmental change has by now begun. 20 years ago, 30 years ago, even 30 years ago, there was already a discussion of that there is this global climate warming coming up, and that it will at some point start to have catastrophic results in our global environment and also our societies. After 30 years now, it seems to be still so that people are thinking in terms that it will, or it might, or perhaps not, or hopefully not, cause this. Although we are now already living in a world which 30 years ago would have been regarded as catastrophical. There are not many days, or at least weeks, in media that you don't hear of a flood or other kind of disaster, a storm, somewhere around the world. It did not used to be like this, but it has moved on so slowly that we kind of get adjusted to it. This is one of the interesting points in history, being a historian myself. For a historian, usually things do not really matter unless they last 30 years or so. Everything has a very long roots. And this being so, us human populations have very hard time to realize the changes around us. We seem to be thinking that this our globe is much more stable than it really is, because fortunately the changes are coming so slowly that we have time to adjust to it. Let's see if I can manage this time. I could. Today my topic is to have a kind of an give you a view of our last soon to end year for an hour until 7 o'clock, using a few slides to go through it. First we have the world system, then environment, then something on the military side of our world, and finally something on the changing attitudes, changing politics, changing ideologies. Starting with the world system, another map. This map is quite modern. I think it's from last year, and it's simply a map of gross national product. The more red, in this case, the more richer country, the more yellow, the more poorer country. And this map, like many, many, many other similar maps, be they of education or healthcare or almost anything, you could check with the colonial map of the imperial times and see it almost the same. Looking from these kind of maps, you can see that what is called post-colonial world really seems to be here. The changes are actually rather superficial from the colonial period to our time, if you count it by production, healthcare, education, or wealth of countries. Of course, everybody has been sliding somewhat upwards, but the division of wealth, of health, of education in this planet has remained remarkably similar as it was made to be during the imperial era, when the Western industrialized countries built their own wealth at the cost of the others, taking resources from the rest of the world in order to build up their own wealth, and they succeeded in it. And this system, they have also maintained. There has been, for the past decades, many times talk that this should be changing, that now it's time for Africa. Africa is rising, Latin America is rising, whatever. But no, the imperial era ended now around something of 60 years ago, in 1960s. So if this would actually be only kind of passing over to another era, it should have happened already. 60 years is actually a very long time, even for a historian. Obviously, it's not changing. This is the world left by the imperial era and in which we still, in many ways, live in. It's a structure that creates basis for our modern world. And that causes many problems. It means that every time the Western world, we try to stabilize the systems, try to get rid of poverty, of wars, and so forth, we actually only validate the system as it is. We are not changing it, we are just trying to keep it stable. Be it the group of seven richest industrial countries, the G7, or the World Trade Organization system, or World Bank and its loans, all of these have been around for a very long time now, but they have not changed the map. They have not changed the division of this world into rich countries and poor countries. It's much more remarkable how similar the situation still is. Those with colonies and those affiliated to colonial powers, like Finland, which was part of Russia, Imperial Russia, are the rich countries. Then countries which managed not to be colonized, but were somewhat semi-colonized, like the Latin American countries, China, Japan, have fared better and have been able to close up. But those who were actual colonies, very few of them have been able to really catch up and be accepted to the club of rich countries. The only area where this has actually happened is in Arabian Peninsula with the oil emirates, but actually they were not really colonized ever. They were kind of protectorates with very ephemeral colonial rule. So their systems, their social and political systems, were not much changed during the colonial time. And thus, despite these attempts to stabilize the system, what is actually happening, and we have seen it happening again this year, is rising resistance from rivaling power centers. In many parts of the world, when they hear it said that our world system is being threatened, their answer is good, because it's not our world system. It has to go. Support in many parts of the world is for a change in the system. And this has been used by rising great powers, like first Soviet Union, which tried to create a kind of parallel system, claiming to be representing those who had been colonized with its socialist ideology, but in the end failing because it was unable to get its social economical system to work and to be able to compete with the capitalistic West. Now we have another competitor, China, which is in a way much more dangerous to the West and to our world system, because it doesn't have this weakness. It doesn't have an economic system that will be weaker than the Western economic system, because it uses the same. But it still manages to place itself in the position of being a rival to Western political dominance. And this way, with each passing year, it seems to be able to strengthen its position, as we saw on the map on the BRICS countries, which almost embarrassingly are actually revolving around China. Chinese economy is so strong compared to the others. China is actually calling the shots almost in the same way as United States is in this Western system. There's always parallel organizations as a sign of what is happening. During the earlier Cold War era with Soviet Union, it was the non-aligned movement in the United Nations. You see the map there. The non-aligned movement is still existing, and the countries on blue are members, and light blue are affiliated members of it. But it never really became a third power it hoped to become, because United Nations kind of lost its position after the end of the Cold War and is no more very important in world politics. So, BRICS is now a kind of a follow-up to this failed attempt to rival the West. And with it, other structures are now coming, like the Asian Infrastructure Investment Bank, formed by China, And during the last weeks, we have seen talk about forming competing currencies to the use of US dollar, which would also be kind of an obvious part of a rival economic political system. This now means that are we or are we not now in a new Cold War? From a historian's point of view, it's kind of an empty question because the original Cold War was never actually defined in any theoretical or structural way. Nobody really knows what it means. It's just a name for an era. It doesn't have any defining factors, except that it means that there are power centers facing each other. If this is so, if this is their definition, then yeah, sure, we are now in another Cold War era. And there are very similar, sometimes paradoxical, means to show it. During the first Cold War era, Soviet Union and its allies created a wall in the middle of Europe in order to prevent their own citizens from escaping to West, where living standards were higher. Now, there is again a wall being built in Europe, but this time it's by the West. And this time the idea is to prevent people from outside to coming in. This time it's not Soviet Union or Russia, its precursor, that is building walls, it's us. But the end result is more or less the same, the division of at least Europe, if not the world, in competing blocks. A few years ago, it would have seemed still that there will be perhaps multi-great power system coming up, not this binary system we had during the First Cold War. But the Russian invasion of Ukraine seems to have now forced everybody to take sides. And at least to me, now in 2024, it seems pretty inevitable that in the end, China and Russia at least will be allies to each other, if they are not already, with India perhaps being in a very profitable situation as it was during the last Cold War in between. Whenever there is a war, the winner is who is not taking part, because wars are always destructive. But if you are not taking part, if you are neutral, if you are outsider, and you are able to remain so, you are not endangering yourself as India, then you will be able to make very profitable trade with both parties. And you will escape the negative effects of Cold War or war between these parties. And India is doing actually very fine. Last year, two Indians were raised among the 10 most richest people in the world. And this was, at least to my knowledge, very much due to the fact that they were able to use Russian energy in order to trade with the West. Brazil, South Africa, oil emirates, yes, there is. It's now rather more complicated because 60 years ago, it was still the West which was by far the most industrialized part of the world. So Soviet Union had a hard time to find allies with which to match that. But now countries like Brazil, South Africa, the oil emirates, are strong enough to work as local great powers in their parts of the world. And this is creating a more complicated vision. Okay, then to the environment, which is not really my speciality, being a historian. So I'm only going to talk of the effects of the environmental crisis, not the causes. I cannot say that I would be a specialist on that. It's obvious that in order to solve a crisis which is global environment would mean that we need a global solution. But it's very hard to get a global solution in this post-colonial world, because such a global solution will probably change the world system as it is. Somebody would suffer more than the others. And this has made it, at least so far, rather impossible to make very far-reaching global cooperation in this sense. The meeting just held in Azerbaijan is a case in point. It was something of a failure, at least from the point of view of environmentalists taking part. And the reason is comes from this division in world systems. It's obvious that this crisis is caused by us, by the Western world. You only have to look at the industrial output and output of pollution to see that. Of course, there are now other industrial centers also in the world, like China. And their pollution is also very high, India as well. But for the rest of the world, the non-industrialized countries, they have no meaning in this sense. So they have not caused us this. We have. And we continue to do so. They are still not causing it. It's still caused by us, by the industrialized countries. It doesn't matter at all what most of the countries in Africa or Asia would be doing, or even poorer countries in Latin America. It's the industrialized center of the world which is affecting it. But then on the other hand, the sufferers are mostly countries which have nothing to do with it. This is very unfair. The world is not fair in this respect. Here you have a map of how climate change will be affecting agricultural yields, different parts of the world. Green is positive, and the darker red or brown you have, the worse it is. And this is almost a map in reverse of the earlier map. Those who have the lowest cross-national product will suffer most from something which they have not caused. Almost the sole place where you could put the blame to somebody who is also suffering is the western part of the United States, which will be suffering very badly in the future because of very dry climate already in this area. But elsewhere, like in Finland, we can even expect higher agricultural yields. Perhaps this is only taking account of the weather. It doesn't take account of the effect of diseases, for example, on agricultural yields. So, when in conferences like that, the Western world is demanding that we should all now lower down our pollution, it seems very unfair in the eyes of those who have not caused this, but will still be suffering from whatever is demanded of them. And they will be demanding in the future as well that they will be compensated for it. Compensated for it by the rich countries, which are rich, they can afford it, and also this has caused this. And on the other hand, it will also in the future be unlikely that the rich countries will go with it, because they fear that they will suffer too much. It's a usual game in politics that if you give in anything, you are expected to give more. And thus, nobody is willing to give up anything at all unless completely forced to do so or compromised with others also giving up something. And this kind of political thinking now fits very badly in our situation when the actual guilt and the actual ability to affect the situation are so one-sided. Okay, the other problem is that the solutions, the main solutions provided, seem to be also dividing the rich and the poor countries from each other. In the poorer countries, the simple solution would be that the rich countries simply have to lower their consumption. Lowering consumption means less use of world resources and less pollution. And this is not at all an illogical claim, as there is at the same time a secondary problem of world's resources being running out. This has nothing actually to do with the climate warming. It means that we are using so much of the resources available, be they mineral, oil, agricultural, whatever, that we are kind of using them up. And this is actually a problem that cannot be solved by any other means than lessening consumption. And so this is a problem that people in the West usually do not want to face. We are much more likely to discuss the global warming than we are the resource crisis, because there cannot be a solution to a resource crisis unless by lessening consumption, because there is no other planet from which to take resources. And thus, the rich countries are favoring technical solutions, the use of less polluting means of consumption, like electric cars, here represented by the Chinese Bud. And for many in the West, this seems to be something of a miracle solution to this problem. But actually, it's a rich man's solution. In poor countries, in Africa and elsewhere, they will never be driving electric cars, because electric cars are rather complicated to maintain, and they need an infrastructure which poor countries cannot afford. You can, if you use an old car using oil, let's say 30, 40 years old, you can actually do much by yourself to keep it going. Modern cars, not that much, because of their being computerized, and with electric cars you can't. So, from the point of view of poor countries, the solutions to favor less polluting technical inventions would only mean that it would underline more this division between the rich countries and the poor countries. They would be left to use whatever old-fashioned cars they would still be around. What else? Oh, that sign up there. I have been kind of waiting or expecting that at some point this crisis would also come into violence, and it has been many times suggested that this will be so, that there will be eco-wars, eco-terrorism, but there still is very little of that. That logo is a logo of a Mexican eco-anarchist, radicalist group, which has at least claims to have set some bombs a few years back in Mexico due to this economical crisis. But it's very unusual. It took me some time to find any example of that aspect. And even that, they haven't done anything since 2019. So it seems that although the crisis is getting worse and it's quite important enough to draw also violent solutions. Its nature is such that it's very hard to know what or who to bomb. It's not easily changed into a political crisis for which terrorism is more clued into. Losing my word, too late in the evening. Okay, and then, yes, I had half an hour for that and half an hour for the other two. I'm quite in timetable now. Breaking rules. Something which is, well, it's not actually, it didn't start this year, but we see it very strongly this year, is the unrestricted use of violence in wars. The breaking down of an international system of laws of war until at the moment they cannot really be functioning at all, especially in the case of Israel and its wars. And why so? It seems that in our world, with its current political crisis, with its new Cold War becoming more warm, there are politicians, governments, which have seen that the excessive use of violence has its political benefits. In the case of Russia, readiness to use massive military power upstages its great power status. Russia has been doing this for more than a decade now. With the fall of Soviet Union in 1990s, there was a decade or so when Russia was very, very lowly regarded in international politics. It was mainly walled over in any of its own political interests, be it in Balkans or Near East or elsewhere, especially by the NATO at that time. And this, by early this century, raised to power in Russia a government under Vladimir Putin, which clearly has decided that it is more important or most important to make Russia a great power again. It has to be. It cannot be walled over. You are not a great power if others do not listen to you, if others do not feel that they are compelled to listen to you. And thus, increasing their military power and increasing the use of military power in Near East and in Africa. The problem with Russians is that the other two main contenders for great power position, United States and China, both are very rich countries, very industrialized countries, which Russia is not. Russia is not very wealthy. It doesn't belong to the world's wealthiest countries. But it has one of the strongest military forces in the world. So the only way to portray itself as a great power still is to use its military power. It seems to me that it tried to first do this in a moderate way. Moderate is not a good word, a very bad word. In a lessened level, to avoid open war, as in the case of the conquest of the Crimean Peninsula, which was actually very, very cleverly done. Nobody died. But 2 years ago, Russian government came up with the problem which other similar militant great powers have in the past. There is a limit where you can bluff yourself. In the end, Russia probably was rather likely to find itself in a position where its bluff is called. And that happened 2 years ago, well, almost 3 years ago now, when It made demand that Ukraine should not be part of NATO. It should be given promises that this will not happen. Threatened war against Ukraine, but the West did not respond. They said that this is nothing to do with Russia. You can't threaten us. I did not believe that there will be a war in Ukraine, except for 2 months before the war. It was around Christmas in 2021, when all attempts to negotiate by Russia with its military power already poised on the borders were turned down, when I realized that we are now on this threshold. If Russian government backs down, it cannot use its military power in a similar way anymore, because everybody knows that this is a bluff. The only way to show that they mean what they say is to do, whatever the cost. I think it's rather misplaced to ponder the cons and the losses to Russian economy or whatever different size of its international standing, or even the position of Ukraine from the point of view of Russian strategy. I think that in a way, Russian government has already won its war. Everybody will take it seriously now, from now on again. From now on, you know that if it threatens with war, it can go to war, whatever the odds, whatever the benefits from it. You can only use military power as a leverage in politics if you are ready to use it. That is, for example, the reason why countries who have nuclear weapons have never, ever given a promise that they will never use nuclear weapons, because if they would, there would be no point in having those weapons. The only point of view of having nuclear weapons is the possibility that at some points they also will be used. And this probably was one of the main arguments with the Russian government to go to war, to have this credibility. So, from Russian point of view, attacking Ukraine and doing it with massive strength without any real interest in international system or the laws of war was, to my mind, probably intentional to show that, yes, we will do unless you negotiate with us. We are not to be held down by anything. Now we have a second similar case with Israel, but probably for very different reasons. In the case of Israel, it's probably down to desperation. The difference between Israel and Russia is that Russia is a big country. It's actually the largest country in the world, and it has one of the strongest military force in the world. Israel is a small country, and it's now playing a great power game in using violence without any hindrance against almost anybody around it, believing that by being this much threatening, it kind of gives an appearance of irresistible power, of strength. Even doing things that doesn't really make that much military or political sense, like the mining of cellular phones. It was a pointless decision to walk over international laws, and probably was partially made in order to show that we are not to be stopped by anything. But the difference between Russia and Israel is that Israel is a small country, and they have now forgotten that. And I fear that in the end, it can't end well for Israeli people themselves. They can't change the fact that they are a small country and now surrounded by people who hate them increasingly. They have no solution. They are not presenting any peace solution now. They don't have a tomorrow in their politics. All this probably caused by their past, by the great bitterness caused by the Holocaust 80 years ago, and the anti-Semitism in this world, and a feeling that they are hated and they are pushed in a corner. Or, on the other hand, also being one of the last remaining white settler societies from the colonial time, which also gives them this uneasiness in the knowing that the way they came in was in a much different situation. The South African whites have a similar problem, that they have this kind of problem of identity in the current world. Okay, so these two are simply examples of how Cold War logic, which has now returned, call it Cold War if you will or not, has eroded rule-based international system based on the UN Charter after the Second World War. It seems that in this situation, in this power struggle, where West and United States is kind of in a losing position and the rivals are pushing, the struggle is so desperate that it's more important to hold on to your allies than it is to hold on to an international system. And thus, China is supporting and protecting and helping Russia, although there is no reason to think that the Chinese would have any interest in Russia actually taking territory from Ukraine. And they probably hate the idea of the war. They didn't want it. They had no reason to wish for it. It's bad for them. But Russia is too important to lose. So they will be helping Russia. The same with USA and Israel. Whatever Israel does, and this is partially probably the reason why the Israelis do it, is to show that the United States will always back them down. The United States will never give them up, whatever they do. And from the point of view of United States, why they are backing Israel, it has much to do with their inner politics, inner political support groups, especially the Christian right-wing millenarist groups. Interestingly, it's no longer the Jewish lobby as before. During the original Cold War, the reason why United States ended up backing Israel was a strong political group in United States itself, the Jewish lobby. But now the Jewish population of the world is very much divided by Israeli actions. Many, especially in the United States, fearing that this will only increase anti-Semitism and that the Israeli politics is wrong. So there is that's not the reason why this strong US backing for Israel still, it's now these Christian millenarists who see Israel having a very important part in their vision of the ending of the world. That when Jesus Christ returns, you have to be on the right side, and the right side is always the side of Israel. It seems strange that this will be so, but there is no real good strategic or political reason to back down Israel. Israel is not strategically based. It doesn't have any resources. It's not a very valuable ally from point of view of real politics. Okay, then on the other hand, this kind of world situation is also very good for terrorist organizations, as was the case with the earlier earlier Cold War as well. Because in a situation where there is much bitterness, much hate, much violence, it's easier for terrorist organizations like Hamas here to use terrorist actions knowing that they will get very harsh reactions. And this is what terrorists are aiming at. And this is something which people seem to be always forgetting. Terrorists are not trying to kill people in order to get power. They are trying to kill people as a means of giving message to the other side. And usually it means to, in order to lure the other side to do something which is so much harsher that it will turn people against it. And here Hamas has been very successful. If Russia has kind of won its Ukrainian war, whatever happens, Hamas has already won its war against Israel. It will be very, very long time now when any Arab country again dares to try to deal with Israel. A year ago, it seems that Saudi Arabia, one of the most important Near East countries, was edging towards making a deal with Israel. But even Prince Muhammad, who is a very ruthless ruler in Saudi Arabia, could not dream of doing it now. By hitting Israel very hard, and I think that killing, decapitations, rapes, all were intentional to create such rage that the Israelis would hit back with quite disproportional force, having now killed roughly 44,000 people, of whom most are by far civilians. Whereas actually in the Ukrainian war, the amount of civilians killed seems to be somewhere between 10 to 15%, which is quite traditional. In this sense, the Ukrainian war is no longer an unusually brutal war, except in military sense. It has become quite traditional war, has been so for over 2 years now. Most of the civilians were killed during the first months of the war. But there is nothing traditional in the Gaza war. And whatever happens to Hamas itself, whatever happens to its leaders, it has achieved the goal. There will be no peace in which the Palestinians will be left out. And then finally, the the ideological side. Parabellum, it's an old Roman saying, qui vic pacem parabellum. If you want peace, prepare to war. It's one of the worst sayings ever. It never made sense for the Romans themselves. They were never in peace. There was always war somewhere. If you prepare for war, you are likely to get war, because then the other side will think that you are more threatening. It seems that people seem to have a very hard time to understand that if we get up more guns, if we arm ourselves, we will be regarded dangerous from the eyes of for whoever we are preparing for. And it will lead with this other side arming as well. So there were quite understandable and good reasons why Finland joined the NATO 2 years ago. But it will be that from now on, we will be treated as a hostile country by Russia, because NATO is a hostile military organization. NATO has never been a defense organization. It has never defended itself. All its wars have been fought outside its own borders. It's a military organization. And that doesn't mean that I will be blaming it, especially more than Russia, which is actually is attacking. But Russians have very good reason to fear NATO and anybody who belongs to NATO. So by preparing war, you will cause the other side to prepare war as well, and that will increase fear and danger It doesn't always end up in wars, but it will make world less stable, no more stable. I have sometimes used an example to my students that me being there at the front alone, and there be many dozens of students there, it's kind of insecure to be here alone. So if I would have a machine gun, might I feel much more safe? But then, of course, the students would feel less safe. So they should have machine guns as well. In the end, if we all have machine guns, are we more secure? Are we really more secure? Do we feel more secure? It's actually a good question. It's no difference between states. But still, it's something in which the problem is this age-old problem of violence, that if somebody uses violence, you can only either surrender or use violence yourself. It's called pacifist dilemma. If you are a pacifist, you will be controlled by somebody who is ready to use violence. There is no alternative. So the reason why we have wars, and I have been studying this a lot, I don't believe in the end that it's in our nature or our biology or whatever. It's because violence is rational. Violence is a means to an end, and we being rational beings, we are ready to use it to our advantage. And this paradoxically also means that we will fear more because we have to fear similar actions from others. So, one answer, popular answer to these kinds of threats and dangers, insecurity, is strong leader. We saw it clearly during the Second World War. You have Hitler and Mussolini and Churchill and Roosevelt and Stalin. All the leaders of main powers in the Second World War are strong, and they are regarded as somehow unusual persons. There was this kind of personal cult made around them. It's very common, usual during wars. We have to believe that there is at least someone who understands this, what's happening, and can do something about it. Even the, as unlikely person as Donald Trump. Populism offers a way to promise easy solutions, not only with war, but with the climate change or the increasing competition for and against our world system. Populists can always promise. Populism isn't actually anti-democratic, because the idea is that you represent the hopes and the wishes of the people who vote you. So populist is doing this. The problem with populism is that it usually is insincere. That you are saying what you are saying, knowing that this is not going to happen. That's what makes populist dangerous. Otherwise, what's so bad in asking people what you want to do and then doing it? Isn't it the democratic system? But with people like Donald Trump, or the latest in his style, the Argentinian president Javier Milei, certainly do not expect that their promises will go through, because they are promising the impossible, and they certainly know it. So, finally, and here I must end, 5 minutes to go, the end result of all this is, and it has been very clearly seen this year, is the rise of militarism, also here in Finland, and masculinism, which is kind of part of it. Militarism, wars, violence, has always been a major factor in a patriarchal society, in a society in which males have political power and are more important because of their perceived ability to defend the society. And this can be seen in our times as well. Concerning the Ukrainian war, as soon as it started, all the, or almost all, the experts or other interested people whom the media has used to comment have been males. I have so far during this 2.5 years seen one case in which two feminist thinkers were interviewed concerning the Ukrainian war. And also you can see it from the pictures of the images of war. They are always males. In fact, 15% of the Ukrainian military force is made out of women. I don't know the figure in Russian military. But all we see is males. And we have this image that males are defending the women and the children, as the, it is the women and the children who will be sent to safety. So women are as lesser beings as children. They are in a position of being children. You can also see that in our elections this year, there were an impressive amount of military men or people interested in military matters to be elected to the European Union Parliament in the Finnish elections. A few years ago, I don't think that almost any professional military, member of professional military would have dreamed of making a political career because they were so insignificant in Finnish media, in Finnish public. But now it's different. And of course, they are all male. So, male-dominated worldview projects self-respect by militarist national values. The Ukrainians must win, and they will win because the Russians are so poor soldiers. Whereas, of course, with the Russians, it's the opposite. One Finn is worth 10 Russians, as used to be said during our continuation war and winter war. Of course, if you think about it, there cannot be difference in the actual military capabilities of a nation because wars are fought between individuals. And individuals have roughly the same kind of capabilities. So the Ukrainians are no better or no worse than Russians or Finns or whatever. But it makes for a good story. It makes us to believe that yes, rightness will win in the end because the heroes will win. The heroes will be somehow better, although they don't have the resources for it. Ukraine can't really win the war. And it has only this autumn been recognized now, increasingly also by the media and the politicians. It has been obvious from the beginning, there is no way the Ukrainian army will march to Moscow, nor there is any reason for the Russians to give up if they don't. The best the Ukrainians can do is to hold out, because they are the weaker side. Wars are in fact rather dull in this respect. You usually can say from the beginning who's going to win. It's the stronger side. And here I think I must end.
Thank you, Risto. This was once again really interesting. Let's now hold a 15-minute break and then continue with the panel discussion.